Well, welcome everyone to the Strong Gravity seminar this week. Speaker today is Spiral from University of Toronto, and I think he will bring to us a very interesting work on singularity formation in black hole materials.
Okay. So thank you, Huang, for the invitation. It's a pleasure to give my lecture at Perimeter, even in this way. So you can hear me. Everyone can hear me, right? So okay. So let me just say, I like interactive lectures. So if anybody has any question at any point at all, you can just speak, completely speak. Please don't type because I have difficulty seeing what you're typing. So just speak. Okay, so the next thing I wanted to say is this is work that I posted about a year ago with my former student, Greg Fornodoulos, soon to be at the University of Crete. I have not given this lecture to physicists before. I hope I've adapted it well enough. Again, the solution if you don't, if you're uncomfortable with something I say, just speak. Okay, so I'd like to start with an example which I assume many of you are very familiar with. And now this won't move. Okay, wait, I have a problem here. This won't, doesn't seem to move. Okay, this works. Okay, so I'd like to start with an example that many people are familiar with about the first example of singularity formation inside a black hole. This was an example well ahead of its time by Oppenheimer and Snyder in 1939. As far as I'm aware, it was also the first example of a black hole. And the proper understanding of this solution and proper geometric understanding actually arose later. But still, so for history mostly, let's recall what Oppenheimer and Snyder started with, their motivation for their work in 1939. So if you read the paper, what they say is that they'd like to understand the analog of the following Newtonian phenomenon. So if you have Newtonian gravity, you can start with a fluid, let's say perfectly symmetric, spherically symmetric, and of constant density, let's say. And you start with that as initial configuration. And you want to understand the evolution. Okay, so as we all know, in Newtonian gravity, gravity will pull the fluid in, okay, and the pressure of the fluid will push out. So there's competition between these two forces. They considered the special case where the pressure is zero. Okay? So in that case, there's only gravity at work. There's no pressure to push back, and so the fluid will shrink, right, in a spherically symmetric way, and keeps on shrinking. There's nothing to stop it. And after a finite amount of time, all the mass will be concentrated at one point. Okay, so after finite time. So the question they asked was, what is the analog of that in gravity, in general relativity? So this solution is explicit. It's one of the few cases that we all know where you can really write out the solution. But what I wanted to present here is more a geometric picture, okay? To describe to you the geometry of the evolving space-time in pictures. Okay? And this maybe is not completely well known, so let me do that for you. Okay, so you can see my cursor, right? I hope, yeah, okay. Okay. So let's start at time equals zero. Our metric, our space-time metric, restricted to time equals zero, is of course a Riemannian metric. And what it looks like is the following: this fluid is supported on, a topological ball, so a portion of S3, a spherical cap, which joins to the portion where there's no fluid, which is a vacuum, and this corresponds to a portion of the Schwarzschild initial data time equals zero. Okay. The geometry where the fluid is supported is, in fact, a cap in S3. We should think it's a portion of S3, right? Less than half. Let's make it's less than half. It's less than a hemisphere, and it joins up with a Schwarzschild vacuum. And in fact, the joining is C11. So the metric is continuous across the joining, right? The first derivatives match. The first derivatives agree on the two sides, but the second derivatives do not. Yeah. So in mathematical language, it's called C11, right? So the second derivatives are bounded on both sides, but they don't agree. Okay. And there's a unique such extension you can do. This is initial data. Now, if you track the evolution, you just consider the evolving solution. So what happens is the size of the spherical portion becomes smaller, right? So the but it exp the portion of the sphere that you're covering expands. So you're covering more of a sphere, right? Let's say initially you were a small spherical cap around the North Pole. Now you're covering more, but the sphere itself is shrinking, is becoming smaller. And at each point, you're joining with a Schwarzschild, right? With a Schwarzschild exterior, in the unique Schwarzschild exterior for which you can do this joining, this C11 joining. That's what the solution looks like. So after finite time in a suitable slice of the evolution, you have a hemisphere, a half sphere, joining up with a Schwarzschild exterior at r equals 2m. Okay, so this is the snapshot after some finite amount of time. Now, let me discuss the evolution of this. So let me rotate coordinates by 90 degrees. So what then happens after this point is interesting. It looks like you formed a portion of the solution at the next snapshot of time. You look like a cylinder, like a topological cylinder, S2 cross R. And you really are, the metric here is the round metric on the standard sphere cross some interval. Black is still vacuum, and it joins up with a hemisphere again, okay, like a cap, which is the unique hemisphere that will make the joining C11. Okay, this is all right. So this is the evolution, and eventually this opens up. So if you were to keep track in space, move in space towards infinity, it actually opens up eventually, but let's not pay attention to this very much now. And now let's evolve a little bit further in time. What's happening to the cylinder and what's happening to this hemisphere? They remain a cylinder and a hemisphere, but they behave in different ways. The spherical components of the metric shrink down, whereas the line component of the metric, right, the cylindrical line, expands out. So you experience contraction in the two directions and expansion in another direction. Okay?
I have a question regarding the cylinder.
Sorry, what? Yes.
I have a question regarding the cylinder.
Please.
Is that it's geometrically a sphere and topologically a cylinder? Is the distinction important?
It's geometrically a sphere and topologically a cylinder. So by cylinder, I just mean S2 cross R. So
But it's not the actual geometry of a cylinder, it's just the topology that you're describing.
no, it is on a time slot, on a fixed moment of time, it really is the geometry of a cylinder. The metric induced on the, yeah. So I'll show a next a Penrose diagram. So the
Okay.
metric induced on some particular time slice is precisely, the round metric across the Euclidean metric in one line. It is exactly
Okay.
that. Okay?
Thank you.
For some portion, for some portion. Okay? So, right. So then in the next snapshot of time, the spherical components are collapsing, the line component of the cylinder is expanding, and at the very tip becomes the small hemisphere that can be added, and this is where the fluid lives. And after a finite amount of time, so what I showed was, let's say, time epsilon before the final time, it has become singular. Okay, so both the where the cylinder lives and where the hemisphere lives, the metric has become singular, as witnessed by the curvature blowing up. Okay, the curvature will actually be blowing up like a suitable power of epsilon. Okay, so this is a description of Oppenheimer-Schneider for specific time slices inside the solution. Okay, so now I'll recall the Schwarzschild solution, or the maximally extended Schwarzschild solution, as it should be called. So it turns out that the vacuum portion I was describing corresponds, one is isometric, to a portion of the maximally extended Schwarzschild solution. That will be the next page. For now, let's recall the Schwarzschild solution in itself. So you can consider two-ended initial data, which I remind you, at time equals zero, the Riemannian metric is like, far away is Euclidean. It joins up and has a neck, okay? And because we're mathematicians, let's consider the maximal extended solution, a vacuum solution, which just has another end, okay? So there's this chitonoidal figure, if you like, with an asymptotically Euclidean end that joins up to another asymptotically Euclidean end through a neck. Okay, and I hope we're all familiar with the Penrose diagram. So the initial data is a surface like this. The evolution of this end yields a null infinity here. There's another end on the other side that yields another null infinity. Okay, and there's a well-known coordinate breakdown at r equals 2m, which corresponds to the event horizon. But we can track the interior of the solution. And the interior is a black hole region. And if you think of the standard coordinates, r, t, and phi and theta, a level set of r is a cylinder, is a geometric cylinder for each r constant inside the black hole. So r is now a time-like function, and a level set of r is space-like. The metric you get on this r equals constant is a perfect cylinder, S2 cross r. So it's a topological and geometric cylinder. Okay. And now let me link the these two. So in particular, the singularity that we observe displays an infinite spatial contraction in two dimensions, in two directions, maybe I should say, the spherical directions, and an infinite spatial expansion in the remaining third direction. Okay. So now let me highlight, in the Penrose picture, this is Oppenheimer-Snyder. Okay. So at each snapshot of time, I was drawing, initially I was drawing surfaces like this, which were inside the, entirely in the exterior region. But after a certain point, I would be drawing surfaces which have constant r, then I would be going out to go to spatial infinity. Okay? But the portion I wanted to stress were these level sets of r, which look exactly like I said. Okay? A cylinder, when you're in the black vacuum region, and a spherical cap in the where the fluid is supported.
Sorry, may I ask a question?
Sure.
So this infinite spatial expansion, are you referring still to the r coordinate or t coordinate?
Yes, so the t coordinate, gtt, is what expands.
Okay.
So I'm looking at a level set of r, and I'm looking at the metric component gtt, which now is space-like, and that is what is expanding.
Okay.
Gtt is like r to the minus 1. Okay. Yeah, so right. Okay. So thanks for the question. So this was Oppenheimer-Snyder, and Oppenheimer-Snyder is a portion of the maximally extended curve. So if we were to consider this portion here to the right, that's exactly what we're seeing in Oppenheimer-Snyder. This portion of Schwarzschild is precisely this black portion there. Okay, it's just that the maximally extended Schwarzschild is, if I took a level set of R, it would just be this cylinder. Okay, and the GTT component of that cylinder would be like R to the minus 1, mass times R to the minus 1. Okay, so we'd experience this expansion, the GTT. The G phi phi and G theta theta would be like R squared. It would be shrinking, you know. Okay. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Yeah. Actually, in their paper, Oppenheimer-Snyder, they adapted a form of Freeman, Robertson, Walker.
Of course, right. Yes.
And with zero pressure and constant density.
Right. Correct. So this I should stress. So the evolving fluid is isometric to a portion of Friedman, Robertson, Walker, with zero pressure. Correct. Yes. Is that shall I? So indeed, I should have said that. Yes. So in fact, I'll return to Big Bang type singularities in a little bit. But so indeed, this metric, the black portion of the metric, the vacuum, is isometric to a portion of Schwarzschild. And the red portion is isometric to a portion of Robertson-Walker, right? And their joining is exactly the unique joining you can do to be C11. Okay. Thank you for the remark. Okay. So now, let me also put down the next example that came out of black holes, all right? And that's the maximally extended Kerr. So the Kerr solution, of course, is very well studied these days, and in the exterior region, let's say very roughly, its qualitative behavior is very similar to Schwarzschild. But in the interior, it is completely and drastically different, and I'd like to stress this. So the Kerr solution, as we all know, at time equals zero, is a perturbation of Schwarzschild, which introduces angular momentum with spin. Let's consider the maximal hyperbolic development of this initial data, by which I mean consider the favorite maximal extension of Kerr that anyone is familiar with here, and consider the points in space-time that can be linked to the initial data by a time-like or space-like curve, right? And every time-like and spatial curve joins the initial data time equals zero. So I'm only considering that, the maximal evolution of Kerr, which is uniquely defined by virtue of our initial data. Okay, so if we had been Schwarzschild, there would have been a singularity here. But what happens when you do the tiniest perturbation is the singularity disappears. There is no singularity, and you can continue solving, and you terminate at what is called a Cauchy horizon. So you terminate, you solve as much as you can by virtue of your initial data, right? And there's a boundary. You can attach to that maximal hyperbolic development a boundary. So the metric extends up to the boundary in a C-infinity way, as smooth as you like. It's real. It's even real analytic. But then that's it. That's how much, as far you can go. You cannot, you could continue, you could consider extensions past this Cauchy horizon if you want, but there are multiple ways to do this. And as far as I'm aware, there's no canonical one. Okay. So from the point of view of the singularity that was here, what happened was it disappeared. So you just change the, you perturb the metric and there's no singularity, it just disappears. Okay. And the solution is infinitely smooth. Okay, so this is an instability of the singularity we observed in Schwarzschild. And, you know, in the sense that Schwarzschild is contained in Oppenheimer-Snyder, it's also an instability of Oppenheimer-Snyder. And this begs the question now, so these are three examples, what should we believe in general? Okay, so I'll return to that question in about 5 or 10 minutes. I want to contrast this discussion with initial singularities, Big Bang time singularities. Starting, of course, with the Friedmann-Rometra, Lobos and Walker, as they're now called. Okay, so these are the most classical examples we learn in a textbook, involve fluids, and usually they have a lot of symmetry. So homogeneous and isotropic is the usual example we consider. And because I just want to stress the geometry, let me not consider the fluid here. Let me just think about the geometry. So in one examples, the metric, if you had toric topology, so S1 cross S1 cross S1, not spherical, but you know, a torus topology, or Euclidean, if you like, R3 topology. One example would be that you can, as you go down to the initial singularity, all directions collapse, okay, at the same rate, and the rate is this, it's T^2/3. Okay, so there's a fluid present to achieve this, but we're not writing out the fluid. I just wanted to describe the geometry. Okay, so the space shrinks to nothing, we would describe in our class, as time goes to zero. So these are Robertson Walker with the presence of fluid or with other matter models that can be considered. Let me also recall the Kastner solutions. The Kastner solutions of Big Bang singularities were discovered in 1921, and they're vacuum. So what distinguishes them from Robertson Walker is their vacuum, like Schwarzschild is and like Kerr is. And maybe all of us are familiar, they display in this Euclidean topology, they contract or they have a very simple behavior in terms of powers of t as t goes down to zero. And there are three fixed powers, q1, q2, q3. And they have an algebraic constraint, in fact, two algebraic constraints. They should sum up to one, and their squares should sum up to one. That's it. That's forced by the Einstein equations. And then subject to these two requirements, these are always vacuum solutions, right? And these have a singularity at t equals zero. So they're Big Bang type singularities. We note, though, that they're very different from this because the two constraints imply that at least one of the q's must be negative. Okay, if they're all right, negative or possibly zero, except for the degenerate case where 0, 0, and 1. Okay, so one, at least generically, except for a special case, one of them must be negative. So there must be expansion in one direction, and then the other two must have collapse. So I stress the Robertson-Walker have a fluid present, okay, and they admit contractions in all directions, at least this example. There's also a generalized Kastner where you can also include a fluid, and then the fluid influences these exponents. I won't talk about that too much. Okay, so maybe. So now let me return to the question of black holes. So this seems similar to what's happening inside black holes, at least qualitatively. So let's return to black holes, and let's ask, what should we expect of a general singularity? So the guiding principle for, at least for science, or at least for us mathematicians, is this strong cosmic censorship conjecture of Penrose from the 1970s, which says, loosely speaking, that generic initial data, if you have black hole development, if you start with initial data, let's say without a black hole, and a black hole forms, and you keep tracking the solution inside the black hole region, then the metric should end at a terminal singularity. There should always be a singularity inside the black hole, and it should be terminal. So terminal meaning that you can't extend the metric past the singularity in any way, not even in a weak way, right? And continue solving the Einstein equations. Okay, this is not completely precise, but it's, I mean, the intent is, I think, clear. Okay, so this is a standard guiding conjecture. So we'll note, for example, that Schwarzschild satisfies this, but Kerr does not. Okay, so you would think that Schwarzschild is a special case of Kerr, but the conjecture is telling you that Schwarzschild is the what you should expect in general, and Kerr is the exception. Okay. So there's even a strengthening of the conjecture, which in addition said that the singularity should be space-like, like it was in Schwarzschild, and it should also involve collapsing in spatial directions. Okay, so that's another strengthening of the conjecture, as far as I'm aware, due to Penrose again. Okay. So here's a two-minute amusing break from us. So the validity of this is widely believed, and here's one example. This is a quiz from the BBC in 2015, I think, maybe 2016, on the centenary of Einstein equations. Okay. So how much do you know about black holes? So this is the one question that I got wrong. How much do you know about black holes? Okay, so when a star collapses into a black hole, all its mass gets squeezed into the singularity, the event horizon, or another dimension. I thought it was the event horizon, okay? But I was wrong. The BBC tells you that it all gets squeezed into the singularity, okay? So now this is evidence that the BBC believes in the strong cosmic censorship as formulated by Penrose, because, it's telling that there is a singularity. Okay, so when the black hole is happening, there is a singularity, that's implied. But even the word squeezed, okay, suggests this infinite contraction, right? So they believe collapsing in spatial directions. Okay, so there you go. The BBC supports the conjecture. Okay, let's go back to serious science. Okay, so that was it. And now, let me also introduce another conjecture, very different, which is this, again, for mathematicians' language, this loosely formulated conjecture of Belinsky, Khalatnikov, and Lifshitz, which say that generically nothing of what we saw before is what is actually happening. In general, everything we said is a special case, and the generic behavior is much more different. And it says generically that the space-time metric will oscillate wildly, okay? So at each point on the final singularity, as you approach it along a time-like curve, you'll experience oscillation between different Kastner-type solutions. Kastner epochs are called. Okay, so you're not converging in any sense to anything, but you're widely oscillating between different Kastners all the time as you go to the general singularity. Okay, so everything we said before was a special case, and they claim this is a generic behavior. Okay. So this was in fact formulated for Big Bang singularities, and it's an extrapolation to say that this is what's happening in black holes. That being said, it's not an unreasonable extrapolation, because the space-like nature of singularities inside black holes makes them, you know, from the causal point of view, they're almost indistinguishable from the Big Bang. Okay? But anyway, it was originally formulated for cosmological singularities. Okay, so I should say there's very little rigorous mathematical evidence in favor of this. So there's this Bianchi 9 spacetimes, which are known to display this behavior, but they're completely explicit and special. Misner, I believe, was used the term mixmaster for this chaotic behavior. I wanted to also stress there's a paper of Hans Ringström more than 10 years ago, who has also studied the solutions in a lot of symmetry, sufficient symmetry so that you reduce to ODEs. But he displayed, he obtained something like this behavior, not a full picture, but it displays that as you're going back towards any point on the initial singularity, in that very high symmetry class, you're bouncing around at least three Kastner. Okay, at least three. So you're not converging to anything, and you're going around at least three different Kastners. Okay. So this is the This is the state of the art, at least for proofs, right? And a special case identified by Belenkin, Khalatnikov, and Lifshitz, actually, was that in some special cases where they say what needs to happen for you to be in the special case, is that there will be no oscillations, and instead the dynamics are what they called asymptotically velocity term dominated. Okay, so I'm not going to define, so there are experts in the audience, I think, who have, are experts on this, but let me just define it in this way. It means if you think of any metric component, the kinetic part, meaning the time derivative, dominates the spatial part, right? Meaning the space-like derivative, in this sense. So the spatial derivatives of the metric are less singular in the sense of a strict power of t, a strictly positive power of tau. Tau is the time as you're going. Time is the time derivatives. So if you want to think that these constitute the energy, so the L2, right, the square of this plus the square of that is the energy, let's say, then all the energy concentrates in the time-like directions. The space-like directions are negligible in the limit. Okay? So, okay, so this is the AVTD behavior, and you have some sort of convergence. Okay, post rescaling, there is some convergence to some limit after you do a suitable renormalization. Okay, that's AVTD. Okay, and they identify within the in a perturbational sense. If you want to perturb Kastner solutions, they identify that in this range you should expect AVTD. In the other ranges, you should expect the more what they call the more generic this oscillatory mixed master type behavior. So that's, as I said, for Big Bang singularities. This is not the object here, but there is work on that, and I'll review a little bit of that now, combining black hole theorems and black hole interior theorems and Big Bang singularities.
I okay. Just interject a comment.
Sure.
Penrose theorem, right, says that during the collapse of a star, geodesics converge towards or equal to zero, and it produces a trapped surface.
Right.
So what happens is that you get geodesic incompleteness at
that's right.
equal to zero.
That's right.
So in the case of the Kerr solution, it's an axially symmetric solution. Asymptotically flat space-time, which is important, by the way.
Right.
And G0 vanishes for certain values of the angles because it's actually symmetric. So in a sense, there is a singularity. I mean, it's you bring in the perturbation, but I it forms an ergosphere, and there is a trapped surface as well as Cauchy horizon.
I fully agree that that's indeed what's happening in Kerr, but the ergosphere and the trap surface are not singularities of the metric. So the curvature, for example, let's use the curvature as our blueprint. The curvature is smooth, is fine, at the trap sphere, right?
Yeah.
So but, right.
But certain values of theta phi, r equal to zero, could be said to be a singularity.
The r equal to zero, I believe, in Kerr. Now we're going to go a bit back. So here's where I can't write on the blackboard. The maximal hyperbolic development terminates at the Cauchy horizon. Now, one could consider solutions that go beyond the Cauchy horizon and which have a time-like singularity here. But that's not what we're... But we're just studying the maximal development. So if you give me initial data, what is the maximal solution you can get by virtue of Einstein's equations? And that does have a... This boundary is smooth. It is a smooth boundary, and the curvature is smooth here. So in terms of the Hawking-Penrose theorem, or the Penrose theorem here, you would look at the maximal hyperbolic development, right? The globally hyperbolic spacetime you can obtain. And the null G-disk would just terminate at this surface. So I should have, yes, I should have stressed then the Hawking and Penrose incompleteness theorems, but I should just stress that what they tell you is that the metric is incomplete. So it doesn't actually tell you that there is a singularity. You could be incomplete like this. You could be incomplete because there's a smooth boundary and just the maximal hyperbolic development has it terminated. Right? So the globally hyperbolic spacetime you can obtain by virtue of your initial data is this one.
So the point is that the G node can vanish.
For
ds squared. So it's not a regular solution.
I do believe that there's confusion in language here because there exist solutions, there exist extensions past the Cauchy horizon, which are indeed not regular, which have a singularity here. But if you think of the globally hyperbolic spacetime that you obtain, the globally hyperbolic spacetime from this initial data, the one that is uniquely specified from this initial data, it is what I drew. And there is no singularity, and I'm sure.
Good.
Okay, so maybe, yeah, maybe we can discuss later, but okay. So I was talking, actually this is a good point to raise because, okay, so papers of De Fermat and Luke show that the singularity we just discussed, that Cauchy horizon and curve that we just discussed, are unstable under generic perturbations of Kerr. So what happens is for a portion of that singularity, and I'll show you which portion, this portion here, a portion nearby that connects to time like infinity, if you generically perturb a Kerr solution, a rotating solution, not Schwarzschild, but a Kerr, the maximal development will have a portion of the singularity being null, weak null is what they're called, but it is singular. Okay, so the it's less singular than what you see in Schwarzschild, but it still is singular. Okay, so in the sense that the metric can't be extended even in a weak sense. Okay, so some Christoffel symbols blow up along a portion of what was the Cauchy horizon, and then further in they just don't know. They're not able to handle it. But you'll have a portion of a Cauchy horizon which is singular in this weak null sense. Still singular, but less than what you see in Schwarzschild. Okay, which validates Professor Moffat's comment that so this Kerr is very exceptional, even within its own family somehow. Even if you have this null hypersurface, generically, by virtue of this example, a portion of it will be singular, but weakly null singular.
This okay. Also depends on positivity energy conditions.
Of course it has. Yeah, of course. Right, yeah, right. Yeah, of course. This is vacuum. Right? So the result was in vacuum. Yeah, of course. So in particular, positive energy is true. Of course. Where everything I say, positive energy is true. So, okay. And now let me recall some examples of black hole singularity formation. So this starts with papers of Rudnyansky and Speck in 2014, 2018, and very recently, like actually this is 2021. December 2020 with my former student for Nodovlos. They study the stability of the Kastner solutions. And what they initially, they studied in high dimensions, not 3+1, high dimensions, and usually with the presence of a scalar field. Recently also in 3+1, but polarized vacuum. Okay. So what they say is the Kastner singularities are stable from the point of view of the backwards in time problem. So you consider the data you have at time equals 1, you perturb that and solve backwards towards time equals 0. So they show a singularity exists. They show this AVTD behavior. And in a sense, convergence, but in a weak sense. It's not full convergence, it's something weaker than full convergence, to a different Kastner solution at each point on that final terminal surface. So let me write it like this. So what they show is not completely this. It's something weaker than this expansion, but let's say consistent with it. So what they get is weaker than this, but somehow of this nature. So it's saying that the metric in a suitably normalized gauge looks like in each direction, you contract like a fixed power of Q, and the Q satisfy the Kastner relations. The coefficient depends, this coefficient is order 1, it doesn't blow up. This is where the blowing up is happening. Okay, and the exponents depend on the point where you're going. So at different points, you're getting different exponents. Okay, so a different Kastner solution at each point, but convergence in some renormalized sense to the Kastner solution at those points. Okay, to a different Kastner solution at each of those points. That's our Big Bang. Okay. And it is a singularity because the curvature blows up. Okay, so the Kretschmann scalar blows up, or the sectional curvature blows up like this, like tau to the minus 2. Okay, now let me go to our result. The black hole interiors and the Schwarzschild singularity and its stability. So as I argued in the beginning, the Schwarzschild singularity is actually unstable. All right, so we know it by virtue of the Kerr examples. So we'll study it in the first class that has a chance to preserve this singularity. So we'll note that the Schwarzschild solution is axially symmetric. So d phi is a Killing field. It's much more than that, but let's just think of axial symmetry. And in fact, it's polarized axial symmetry, which means that this Killing field is normal to the other three directions. So in a very concrete layman's term, there's no g phi t, no g phi theta, no g phi r. There are no cross terms. The metric splits like the Killing direction, and then the remaining 2 plus 1. That's what polarized symmetry means. Okay, and so the paper we posted about a year ago is the following. So consider Schwarzschild data, let's say at r equals m. So you're inside the singularity already, r equals m. And consider perturbations of that data, which preserve axial symmetry, in fact, preserve polarized axial symmetry. So we're looking at polarized axially symmetric perturbations. Okay, then the solution will preserve these symmetries, and it will develop a singularity, a space-like singularity. And in a normalized gauge, the metric will look like this. Okay, so let me make this clear what's happening. This is a gauge normalization. I'm normalizing the parameter r to be exactly what it is in Schwarzschild. It's a gauge normalization. This can be done by gauge. Okay, and then I'm normalizing the gauge a bit more. I'm not saying how now. But there are three principal directions of contraction and expansion. So phi and theta will shrink with powers of r, 2 alpha and 2 delta. And the t direction will expand, right, with a power of r. And the final surface to which we're going has coordinates t and theta. Everything is phi independent, so there's just t and theta. Let's think of it that way. And the exponents depend on the point where you're at. Right? So the exponent you have depends on the point on the final singular surface where you're approaching. There are also cross terms, but the cross terms are less singular, so they don't count. These are the three principal directions. Okay, so that's the result. AVTD behavior. And in fact, you can, the key driver is this component of G phi phi, the killing component of the metric. Right? So in the sense that if you tell me that exponent, then the other exponents are all explicit functions of that, completely explicit. Okay? So you solve a quadratic equation, you get them. Okay, and their values, because this is a perturbation result, their values are close to what they are in Schwarzschild. So for Schwarzschild, alpha would be 1, delta would be 1, and beta would be minus a half. Okay. Actually, this should be a 2 here. Sorry, there's a typo here. This should have been a 2. So these are functions now, but they're close, point-wise close, to the background Schwarzschild values. So a perturbation result. Okay. So this is the result, and I'd like to present some of the ideas in the proof. I believe I have a little more than 10 minutes. Is that, I hope I'm correct.
Okay. Yes, Piers, can I just interrupt now?
Sure.
Can you go back to the previous slide with the results?
Yes.
So I would have thought that, you know, approaching your singularity and approaching a Kastner type singularity would have been, you know, pretty similar. So is there a gauge where you can,
you can cast this
in a Kastner-like form?
Exactly, yes, there is. So if I put, I used R to be like Schwarzschild, if I used arc length somehow, like minus dt squared, you would be a Kastner, and I think the exponents are, let's see, I think it's minus 2/3, 4/3, and 4/3. So it is Kastner. It is Kastner in disguise. In spherical topology, right? In spherical topology. But yes, indeed, there are the Kastner exponents. 4/3, 4/3, and 2/3. And minus 2/3.
So it's Kastner, but it's not degenerate Kastner where you can have, you know, well, I guess a one-parameter family of
I confused. So the Schwarzschild has Kastner exponents, which are four thirds, right, and minus so two-thirds. That's for Schwarzschild. And my guys have exponents which satisfy the Kastner relations, and they're close to four-thirds, close to four-thirds, close to two-thirds. That's the correct thing.
Okay, so the intuition is that the approach to this singularity is similar to the approach to a Kastner singularity. I'm not saying that's right. So the approach to your singularity is basically like in the formulation of the other people, Rodiansky and Smek and I think I've lost your voice, Piers.
We cannot hear you.
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yeah,
you're back.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll take this off then. Okay, I'm sorry about this. Okay, yes, so the we do go, in a suitable sense, you're seeing Kastner exponents on our result too. Okay, so in this result, you're also going to different Kastner exponents. The topology is S2 cross R, but locally near every point on the sphere, the curvature of the sphere should not be important, is what we think. And indeed, this is validated here.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Okay. Now, maybe I'll say now, what we get is strict. The description we get as you go to the singularity is much more detailed than what they get. So these asymptotics are actually true. It really is asymptotics like that. In their setting, it's not quite so detailed. Okay. So now let me try to introduce some ideas and some new methods we introduce. So the first idea is very general, and it concerns axial symmetry, really. Here I'm going to discuss a polarized axial symmetry. So we're thinking about 3+1 metrics, which have this splitting. Okay, this is a Killing direction. This is a Killing, so this is constant in phi. And there's the remaining metric, the 2+1 metric. Okay, so then I think it's very well known to many people that the Einstein equations in this symmetry class are equivalent to this following system. So if you look gamma to be the, let gamma be the log of this, then you have a free wave for gamma, okay? And the Ricci curvature of the 2+1 metric is given by this explicit expression of gamma, okay? So you might think that, okay, I didn't win much because, all right, a wave equation is simpler to handle than the Einstein equations, but there's still this bit, right? And that's possibly even more complicated because you've got a right-hand side. The key thing, the key intuition is that the second equations are expressible as ODEs, fully rigorously. This is not a simplification of any kind. They really are ODEs. So let me introduce the gauge I want to choose. So let's think of geodesic gauges. Okay, so I have an orthonormal frame and I use parallel transport along a geodesic. So this defines a family of geodesics, and I parallel transport my frame. And I consider these connection coefficients. I call them the time derivative of the metric. For now, let's just call them connection coefficients. These particular ones, the k's, the extrinsic curvature. Okay. So our system reduces to the following. So box of gamma is zero, but then E0 of k by just the Riccati equations, the Reichardt-Hoare equations, if you prefer, can be written as k times k times a curvature component. But in 2+1 dimensions, the curvature is expressible in terms of the Ricci curvature. So the full curvature component is directly expressible by the Ricci curvature in 2+1. In higher D, of course, that's not true. There's also Weyl, but in 2+1, it is true. So we get this wave equation on gamma and evolution equations on K, these extrinsic connection coefficients. And there's also some intrinsic connection coefficients. I call them little a here. So there's a corresponding equation like that. Okay, a corresponding first order ODE in that, these are the parameters A. This captures, let's say, the time derivatives of the metric. This captures somehow the spatial part of the metric. Okay. Of course, we shouldn't forget that this is really a quasi-linear. This is still nonlinear. And the reason is that you have a wave equation on gamma, but the metric, right, depends on gamma by the second equations. So we really should think G is a function of gamma. So this is somehow an equation on gamma, which is nonlinear, because the metric is evolving depending on gamma via these equations. So this is something very general. Okay, it's not, it's way beyond black hole uniqueness. It's somehow, it's a way to reduce the equations to a free wave, which mathematically, I imagine physically also numerically, is easier to understand. Okay, plus ODEs, and ODEs are definitely easier to understand. Okay, so let me now work a bit on the formal level. I won't give the, okay, just 1 minute of formal study. Okay, so let's pretend that our metric was very close to Schwarzschild, or actually let's say our metric was like I believe it will be. So let me pretend that the metric satisfies the asymptotics I already said. Okay, so it is like I expect it to be. Then how should the wave behave near the singularity? And the answer is formally you can see that it has an expansion of this form. So it'll be some alpha, the same alpha you drew before, a function alpha of t and theta times log r, plus a constant term in r, plus something that vanishes faster in r. So formally, this is true. Formally, like if you're just trying to solve the equation iteratively somehow, this is what you find for gamma. Okay, so let's believe this is true. And let's try to understand then how do the ODEs behave? Because after all, the forcing terms in the ODEs are determined by gamma. So if gamma has this expansion, the forcing terms will have a certain expansion. Okay, so the important ones are K. The nonlinear ones are K. Okay, this is a nonlinearity. So this is the most essential. The other one is, you know, numerically, mathematically is not difficult to handle if you've controlled K. So let's focus on K, okay, this component. So let's remember we're in 2+1 equation, 2+1 dimensions. So there are two principal directions. Okay, I'm gonna call them 1 and 2. Now, let me put in my mind, 1 will correspond to the expanding direction, and let's say 2 corresponds to the contracting direction. Okay. So, okay. Now, so formally, if you study them, you'll see that by virtue of the forcing term here, to leading order, K11 and K22 will behave like this. Okay, their leading order will be like r to the minus 3/2. Okay. So with a coefficient beta and a coefficient delta in front. Okay. Now, K11 has also a free branch, if you think of ODEs. K22 doesn't have a free branch, it only has one solution, only one. So if you give me gamma, there's exactly one solution of K22, which does not blow up before r equals 0. So let me explain why this somehow makes sense, after the fact of why this makes sense. So what we're trying to do is you want to use geodesic gauge to go to the singularity. Okay, that just from a gauge point of view, that's very dangerous because geodesic gauge can blow up, okay, right? So they can break down. That geodesic gauge can break down. So you consider parallel time that geodesics, you shoot them, and right, and you can have the Einstein equation tell you there's going to be contraction, and you can have a blow up of the gauge. You can have a breakdown of the gauge before you reach a singularity. Yeah, this can happen in Euclidean space. You could think of a circle, you think of the geodesics that point inside, you shoot them out, right? And the corresponding K will blow up. That doesn't tell you the metric is singular, it just tells you the gauge blew, the gauge broke down. In this thinking, the expanding direction sounds very safe, because expansion is your friend, right? If you're going towards geodesics that are parallel but in the expanding direction, then the fact that the space is stretching out should tell you they shouldn't break down. Okay, that's K11. The contracting direction is very, very, very dangerous, right? Because not only in general, and Minkowski can have geodesics that that cross, a gauge that breaks down, and here you're moving in a direction where you have infinite contraction. So it's really dangerous that you could have blow up. So what this is really doing, it's capturing the unique geodesics which do not blow up to, all the way to the singularity. The unique geodesics whose gauge, right, whose expansion doesn't break down prior to the singularity. Okay, so a generic geodesic that you shoot towards the singularity would break down, but there's a very, very distinguished family, and this is the distinguished family. It's captured by these Ks, which will satisfy this expansion. Okay, and as I said, these exponents are completely explicit functions of alpha, where alpha comes here, okay, in terms of the wave. So the wave drives, if you like, the wave is the driver. Okay, and the others are, okay, if you have the solution, you plug it in and you check what asymptotics you get, and you get this. Okay. So now a sequence of strange things happen, which I don't completely understand. So one is this. It's very important in this business, in the previous approaches, that somehow you synchronize your approach to the singularity. We're doing that using GD6 here. The traditional way is to use surface of constant mean curvature. So what's happening here is with these GD6, because of these explicit relations, you know, if you have these expansions, then the mean curvature is actually constant, the leading order constant, for free. I didn't impose this. I derived it. This follows from these expansions. Right? So it's not perfectly constant mean curvature, but it's the leading order it is. Okay. So we call this CMC for free. CMC is constant mean curvature. CMC for free. Okay, this was a formal study. Okay, we really have a theorem. So we're not doing formal studies, we're really doing a theorem. So how do you convert this formal study into a proof? So the first thing is this gauge issue, the fact that you're expecting to see collapse, and collapse is very, very dangerous if you're using time like GD6, forces you to originate your GD6 at the singularity where you're trying to go. Okay, that's where you're trying to reach. So we're going to normalize our GD6 to be at the singularity. Okay, so I'm starting from the singularity and I'm shooting back. Okay, this sounds circular, but it's not. So the way we don't make it circular is we do an iteration. Okay, so somehow I solve for the wave on the previous background. I then solve for the Riccati's. I solve for all the parameters. Okay, and then I iterate again, right? And then I solve, and this defines a new space time on which I'm going to solve the wave again. Having solved the wave, I'm going to solve for the Riccati. So an iteration. Okay, and now here comes the second challenge. There's a total of three, but here's the second challenge. If you want your wave to behave the way we said, that logarithmic blow up, it is absolutely essential that you have this asymptotically CMC behavior. Okay? And not only for the K, not only for the K, but also for the derivatives of K. So we have to work in what's called Sobolev spaces. We need to differentiate the equation. To prove theorems, you need to differentiate the equation. So we need not only K, but also its derivatives to behave in the way the formal solution predicts. Okay. So now let's look at the equation for K11 and let's differentiate it. Differentiate in space. So I'm differentiating, let's say, in dt or d theta. Okay, so I'll get an equation like this. It's a linear equation with the derivative. And I can try to do this formal analysis again. And what I find is it has a free branch, which is exactly what it was before, r to the epsilon. Okay, this is saying that you look at your undifferentiated equation, you believe that your K has an expansion like this, has a term like that. And if you differentiate in t, there's still going to be a term like that, whose coefficient will be like dt of this. Okay, so this is expected. Okay, so far so good. Okay, that's the expanding direction. In the contracting direction, we get something very different, which I really basically don't understand. So it says you differentiate the equation, you get a linear equation too, and our linear equations have a free branch. The free branch here is like r to the minus 3. Almost r to the minus 3. And remember, we're expecting the behavior of k to be r to the minus 3/2. So this is way more singular, right, than what we would like k22 to behave like. Okay. So if this free branch really existed, if these spatial derivatives were so much more singular than the undifferentiated quantity, we would be dead. There would be no way, no mathematical way to prove that this is really what's happening. It would just break down. We wouldn't be able to prove anything if this really happened. So the only hope is that somehow this doesn't happen, right? Okay, formally it's allowed, but in reality it's not there. So the coefficient of this term, in other words, is 0. Okay? Okay, so this is the second reason that we work with an iteration and we originate in our iteration. We will originate at the singularity for K22. So this allows, this is a first order ODE. There's a free branch, there's a free, I can put a coefficient in front of this. I put that coefficient to 0. I set it to 0 myself, okay?
Sorry, can I interrupt you? So does it mean that you're assuming the solution that you want to get, basically?
I am not doing that. I am not assuming. I will prove the solution, but I'm highlighting a difficulty. And let me say now how I avoid this difficulty. This is not really there. This doesn't really happen. I prove it doesn't happen.
Okay.
Thanks. Let me say how. Okay. So I'm not going to solve the real equations in one go. I'm going to do an iteration. And my iteration will be like this. So each metric consists of a gamma and the 2+1 metric. And so in this gauge, the initial data I prescribed lives on some hypersurface, which I need to find. So please think that there's a GD6 originating at the singularity, and at some, you know, on some hypersurface, my initial data live. So the hypersurface needs to be solved for. I need to find where in this gauge does my initial data live. It has to be solved for. The iteration is at step zero, if you like, or whatever step, I have my initial data and I solve the wave equation forwards. I already know that the metric has the behavior I expect. The previous iterate has the behavior I expect. I know that inductively. So I can solve my gamma and get the asymptotics I want. Now, the Riccati's, Richard Hoare, if you prefer, for these two parameters, I need to solve backwards. So I need to start at the singularity and I set that dangerous branch to zero. I did it myself. I set it. Okay, so then now that I've solved backwards, I need to find the next hypersurface where the initial data should be induced. Okay, and that for I am able to do that. I can find the next hypersurface where this, in order where the at least some of the data will be induced. And then the remaining data I have to prescribe on that hypersurface. Okay, so that gave me my next 2+1 spacetime. And I can iterate again. So I'm setting up an induction where I'm iteratively constructing spacetimes, wave first, and then the metric, the 2+1 metric. And in a limit, I can prove that in a limit, it will convert to a real solution of the Anderson equations. And all the things I claimed are true. They're true at each step. And you know, they convert, I have converged in the limit.
So I think the worry is that when you do this iterative process, you may get one class of solutions, but there could be an entirely different class of solutions that you're not getting from this iteration.
Yeah, so I work hard to ensure that doesn't happen. So I can show in the limit three things. One is the solution satisfies the vacuum Einstein equations. Number two, my initial data on some hypersurface, the limit of these defines some hypersurface. My initial data are what I prescribed. Okay. And constraints and all that propagate. And I have, you know, the bounds, they didn't blow up. I'm not adding anything. The bounds that all the bounds I claim, the CMC, these expansions and so on, that each of them has a separate limit. So I proved that.
Thanks.
Okay, so this is the big outline of the idea. And from a mathematical point of view, there were some new things we had to do, right? Which would, for example, even this find the hypersurface where your initial data will live is not an easy thing to set up. Anyway, we've got it. So let me just close by saying some things that may be of broader use. So beyond singularities, beyond so on, I find that this gauge of studying the Einstein equations in this symmetry and making them into one wave and then ODEs could be helpful. So in this gauge, it really becomes one wave equation. In polarized, it's a free wave. It's a linear wave. In non-polarized, still axisymmetric, it's called the wave map, but similar. And then ODEs. So I believe this will be helpful for other problems. So for some problems, maybe we can study the Einstein equations in this gauge other than other ones. Okay. The second thing is this. Problems of this nature, somehow very supercritical problems, very hard problems, have received extensive treatment with more symmetries than one. Okay, for example, spherical symmetry. Okay, so, and we have understood. I mean, there are many, many solutions that are obtained in spherical symmetry, but they're still somehow hard. They're still supercritical. They still have a singularity. So this possibility raises the chance that take any of the solutions obtained in spherical symmetry, any, and then study perturbations of that solution in axial symmetry. So take away one degree of symmetry. It's possible that this will yield fruit, that this might be successful. Okay, and let's go specific specific other mathematical challenges. So the Schwarzschild that I discussed is the Schwarzschild that I started with is this maximally extended Schwarzschild, which has two ends. What is of course much more physically relevant is to have one end, right? And maybe some matter inside, okay? So it's possible, right? So no result outside spherical symmetry has been able to handle that. Okay, so Defermo's loop, as I said, for example, it doesn't apply to that, right? You can't go to the one-ended initial data. Somehow something breaks down. It's possible that this could be helpful. This new approach could be helpful for that. Okay, and even beyond, black hole exteriors, for example, possibly in this gauge, or Einstein equations and other cosmological constants. Okay, so that's it. That's my lecture for today. Thank you very much for your attention. Okay.
Thank you. Any more questions for Spiros?
I'd just like to make a comment.
Sure.
This question by BBC, what do we know about black holes? So I just wanted to remind that we have to separate what we know from theory and what we know from experimental and observational data. And for the latter, we don't know that much, really. We know the LIGO gravitational wave data for merging black holes, the Event Horizon Telescope data for M87, and X-ray binaries. And there's no rigorous proof experimentally that Einstein horizon exists. And of course, we can't look inside a black hole, so we don't know what goes on in there. Also, for an external observer in GR, the horizon and the singularity occur at infinite null future. It takes an infinite amount of time before they form for an external observer.
Mm-hmm.
So, just wanted to remind us that physics is ultimately experiment, and just wanted to remind us what we know and we don't know.
I agree. Thank you.
I think Will also has a comment or question.
Hi, Spiros. Thanks for the nice talk. I just had a question about this issue of one-ended initial data versus the two-ended initial data. So do you have any intuition whether or not that's going to be that might give a big difference? Like, is that just sort of a technical point trying to adjust the one-ended initial data with some matter interior or something? Or is there some reason you might believe that might give you a totally different result with regards to either the case you discussed or the Kerr case in the Cauchy horizon?
Let's see. So let's separate one-ended initial data in itself. So we need to start with some solution. So you need to give me some solution. Let's take one solution obtained in spherical symmetry, okay, with, let's say, scalar field or whatever. My hope is, and my belief also is, that the one-ended initial data is more, is not the real. So if stability were true, if stability of this kind were true, in the region far from the where it closes up, I would think it's just still true where it closes up to. That's my guess, and I'm not the big expert. Okay, but that, I hope and believe that is true. So somehow, if the matter field allows, the fact that it's one-ended, the fact that somehow it closes up, doesn't really matter. So some matter fields might yield very different results. For example, Oppenheimer-Snyder with zero pressure maybe is not a very good, it's a good historical example, but that matter field is very special. But so, I don't know, for more reasonable matter fields, if you could do something in the cylindrical region, a local result in the cylindrical, then it should also be true where it closes up. That's my guess. Have I answered?
Yeah, thanks.
Eric also has a question. Eric, we cannot hear you. You're muted.
Yep, sorry about that. So a couple of things. So the polarized ansatz, I mean, that's a pretty, I guess that's a pretty severe restriction on the degrees of freedom. So do you have any, you know, intuition as to how, well, I'm sure it would be infinitely more complicated to remove that assumption, but in terms of what you might expect the approach to the singularity to be.
I can tell you what I expect. So think, and I hope again, that this hasn't been done, that you could rule out, you want to rule out Kerr, okay? Because Kerr is drastically different. I think and hope and think that just axial symmetry with zero spin, right, with zero angular momentum, you should see the same behavior, AVTD behavior. Yeah, that's my hope.
Okay.
So zero spin, non, right? So in axial symmetry, angular momentum is obtainable everywhere, right? So it's not just an asymptotic at infinity notion, but it's there's some conservation law, and you can, for any sphere homologous to infinity, you can define the angular momentum, and it's the same. So if you're in axial symmetry, non-polarized, and have no spin, I'm hopeful that, you know, the result should, the same behavior you should be obtained. It should be AVTD. You should go to a caster in this type of each at each point. That's my hope.
Right. So your hope would be, your hope or your conjecture would be that it's not BKL, it's going to be just one Kastner epoch.
Yeah, I would, yes.
For each special point.
I don't know what BKL conjecture in this connection. I'm not so knowledgeable, but okay.
Right. So the other thing, and I don't want to drag it on for too long, but I was fascinated by your story about the free branch. So do you have an intuition? I mean, here's something that looks like a part of a solution that has, you know, that eventually is shown not to be part of the solution, but why was it there to begin with? I mean, where does it go? That thing?
That's the most interesting question in my mind. I really, really don't know. So let me say one small thing. If you think just in terms of counting degrees of freedom, okay, you should say that the free branch is not needed. At least in polarized symmetry, you just count degrees of freedom, how many you've got. You get to set it to zero and you can still solve the problem. You're still at the correct number of parameters that you expect you should have. Okay, so that you could say that says this shouldn't really be there because it gives you too much freedom. Right? But I really don't know. So it could be just a gauge issue. It could be, and that would be, let's say, bad for us. It's somehow, it's just there because of some gauge that you chose and whatever. Or it could be some, you know, could correspond to solutions that could have somehow these very rapid spatial oscillations. I don't know. So I did already, the short answer is I don't know.
Yeah, no, really interesting. Thank you.
All right, any additional questions?
Just one quick comment. Since we're going to R equal to zero, we know that matter is, the theory of matter is quantum mechanical. Right. So quantum mechanics would have to come in at some point to avoid the infinity R equal to zero. I would suggest.
Yeah, so I agree. So yeah, so this is within the realms of classical relativity.
That's right, Eric.
So if one assumed that quantum effects will kick in at small scales, all this becomes irrelevant. Right? So the quantum effects will take over, and then, you know, general relativity is no longer an adequate description. So indeed, no objection at all. But okay, this is within classical general relativity.
Okay. For the reason of time, I think we should stop here. So let's thank Spiros again for this wonderful talk.